This talk was given by Prabhu Gikan Basan at the Zen Center of New York City. Gikan is a senior student in the Mountains and Rivers Order. This talk, like all our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation, please visit our website at zmm.mro.org/donate. Thanks for your support.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Gikan. And I was asked to give the talk today. First, I just wanted to say, as always, it's great to be down here in Brooklyn, my old stomping ground. I'm referring to this stomping ground where most of my practice and training has taken place. Also, I just wanted to welcome everyone here. Every time, since I don't come here all the time, my wife and I are living in Albany now. Every time I come here, I see new people. And so that's nice to see. So I just wanted to welcome everybody here, especially if you're here for the first time. We had a good-sized group for beginning instruction, so welcome. I hope you're enjoying the morning so far. I wanted to start with a few lines. I was told that I move my hands too much when I talk, and that creates problems, so I'm going to try my best not to, but I'm probably going to fail. Oh, I'm also being told I need to move this thing up. Okay. There. All right. Is that better? Yeah. All right. I want to start with a few lines from the Avatamsaka Sutra. And for if you're newer here, Avatamsaka can be translated as a garland of flowers, and Sutra is a teaching that's either historically or spiritually attributed to the Buddha himself, the Shakyamuni. So this is the Buddha, this is from the Buddha's flower garland teaching. On the body of each Buddha appear many beams of light. In each beam of light appear many lotuses. In each of these lotuses appear many petals. In each of these petals appear many wondrous jewels. Each of these jewels manifests untold worlds. All of these jewels manifest all worlds. So this is an early, maybe the earliest, but certainly an early image of what would come to be called, what would develop into the jeweled net or the diamond net of Indra, which is what I wanted to look at today. You know, when I started working on this talk, I was thinking about what to talk about, and I was sort of thinking about where we are now, you know, at this time in this place in a couple of different ways. First, you know, it's the year is still pretty new, and I know that, you know, it's a time of beginning. I know people make resolutions. A lot of people, some of the people here who practice here regularly or up at the monastery regularly, actually made, you know, vows. We did a New Year's opening ceremony and we offered incense and we made a vow. So in other words, you know, it's a time to commit or to recommit to things that we feel are important in our lives, the things that we want this year to be about. It's also winter, and in our particular training matrix, our matrix of spiritual practice, winter is a time where, you know, it's kind of an intentional lull, so to speak. You know, the intensity of our fall practice period is over. The intensity of the spring practice period hasn't come yet. So, you know, it's kind of like an intentionally built sort of period of being able to sort of practice in a way that doesn't have that intensity, but is still a practice. And I've also, of course, been sitting just with the state of the union, as it were, right? The upheavals of late. And I'll mention a little bit more about this later, but yesterday a number of us from the Sangha met with other Buddhist groups for the initial convening of what is hoped to be a Buddhist progressive kind of political organization. However that will turn out to be, a number of very eminent Buddhist teachers were there, and they really want to kind of make this into like a call of conscience, a unified sort of front, or unified calling for Buddhist practitioners. So that's been on my mind, you know, the state of things and the need to respond, the urge to check out, all of that was part of the conversation that we had yesterday, and certainly that I've been having. So with all of that, I felt the need to return, to return to something very basic, right? To return to the beginnings of a practice, right? I felt that this is a good time to sort of return to something very foundational. And I really began to ask myself, well, what is the basis of what we're doing here? The basis of Buddhist practice. And of course, the first thing that occurred to me was, well, Zazen, right? Duh. It's the first thing that we're taught when we walk in here, right? And in some ways, it's the first thing, right? It's the practice of directly experiencing us and whatever we think is not us, right? I then thought about maybe the Four Noble Truths, the first teaching of the Buddha, his presentation of what he discovered that really forms the basis of everything else that's taught. But as I kind of sat and reflected on this, what kept coming up was the diamond net, right? The jeweled net of Indra. It's a metaphor, of course, for our inherent interconnectedness. The excerpt that I read, let me just say that that's actually my condensation of what is really like in the Avatamsaka Sutra. It goes on. I mean, it goes on and on. You know, it's like within each jewel is a major light. Within the major light, there's a minor light. Within that, there are golden thrones. On each throne is a moon. In the moon, there's a lotus. The lotus has petals. That shoots out rays. I mean, just, it goes on. And, you know, I've read it a number of times, and it's actually a pretty hypnotic, actually. You know, it's, and I like it. You know, it's this ecstatic, rapturous, lush rendering of interconnectedness. When I read it, I feel like I'm kind of in a jungle, and they're just these vines. Like my wife and I went to Peru last year, and we were like in like the jungle of Peru, and it was just like there's like vines and trees and roots and branches just everywhere, and we were in it, like it or not. We liked it, but we were in it, like it or not. And that's what that feels like to me. A more contemporary version that I think we're more familiar with is literally the image of a net. The entire universe is seen as a very vast and fine net. And every piece of phenomena, every object, every form, every thought, every mental construction, every emotion, every piece of what we call inner or outer reality is a jewel held in that net. And the jewel has a huge number of facets so that each jewel reflects every other jewel. Right. So the implication is that whatever affects one jewel affects everything else, right? If you remove a jewel, that'll be reflected in every other jewel. If you damage a jewel, that'll be reflected. If you shine a jewel, that'll be reflected in every other jewel, right? A couple of commentators have said, therefore, no jewel can be thought of independently, and the nature of each one is defined by its relation to all the others. I'd like to suggest that that image is an image of our most basic condition. Right? Before we do Zazen, before we sit a minute of Zazen, before we come to practice, before we hear of the Four Noble Truths, before we recognize our own suffering, and in fact, before we even begin to suffer. Whether we understand that as just the episodes of suffering and dissatisfaction we encounter in our days, or large scale, before we begin to suffer in this large cycle of samsara, before any of that, we are already held in this net. And we're held in it completely and harmoniously and peacefully. Now, to some of us, this image of this texture of connection might come as good news. Right. And I think actually some people actually even enter practice with an intuitive sense of this. I remember years ago, Miyotai Sensei, who used to be the abbess here, she used to teach here, she once remarked that some people enter practice through suffering, and some people enter it through joy. Right. And I think, that bears on this. You know, suffering, as it's understood in Buddhism, arises from our experience of ourselves being completely separate and distinct in a world where everything else is separate and distinct, right? That and the implications of that is what leads to suffering. And joy is, if you look at all the teachings that I've read, joy is what comes as that in experience of separateness begins to, we begin to let go of it, right? So I think for some of us, even a hint of that interconnectedness, even though we might not understand it or experience it, might be a relief. That was not the case for me. I will say that right now, okay? My first reaction when I encountered this image was resistance. Okay, I distinctly remember when I heard Miyotai say this, I thought, like, who are these people entering through joy? Come on, what's that about? Jerks, you know? It's kind of like, geez. And not just to this, but in general, you know, my tendency has been to recoil away from anything that I've encountered in this practice that links my practice, my fate, and my life to everyone else's, right? I remember when I was studying the precepts. The precepts, very briefly, to receive the precepts is to make a formal commitment to the moral and ethical teachings of the Buddha. And I was, you know, I was studying them while resisting them at the same time, right? And I take in the intro, the precepts retreats over and over again, to the point where Ryushin Sensei, who was teaching back then, once, I think he said out loud when I came in for another retreat, he's like, oh, and here's Prabhu, who has set a Sangha record for taking the most number of precept retreats without actually taking the precepts, right? And I was in face-to-face with him, a private interview, and I was really working at this, and he was like, what's your problem? Like, why aren't you taking them? And I totally think I actually said this to him. I think I looked at him and said, look, I have enough on my plate. Now on top of everything, I have to be good. I mean, that's, I literally think those words came out of my mouth. Yeah, the patience of our teachers never ceases to amaze me, actually. You know, the funny thing is, I was actually working in a helping profession at that time that I was going through all of this, right? I had finished training as a clinical social worker. I was working in mental health clinics and, you know, in public mental health clinics, you know, in housing projects, you know, so I was working in places of great need, and I was perfectly clear that that's where I wanted to be. You know, I wanted to be of service. I had absolutely no issue around that, right? So it was interesting that I'd be able to do that and at the same time have this kind of resistance, right? And I think it's because I had drawn a line as to how far I wanted to go with all of that, right? At that time, that line was, you know, I'm over here helping you over there, right? And, you know, and I thought that was fine. You know, I thought, okay, I'm a good guy, you know, helping people. You know, I went to grad school for that. I'm now helping people. I'm doing good work. I thought, you know, okay, so my life is in alignment with what the teachings offer, right? Like, what's the issue? I didn't realize that, and that was fine. I didn't realize how short that fell. I didn't realize that this vision of totality, right, of unity, that this image of the net is offering, and that the Buddhist teachings are really emphasizing, and that the not an invention, a discovery of the way things are, it was much more, right? Much more than what I thought I could. It was much more than that line I had drawn, and that boundary I had set. My Dharma brother Gokhan gave a talk here a little while back, where he referred to, he mentioned that there's a part of ourselves that keeps turning away from wholeness, right? I was actually glad to hear him say that, because I realized, oh, I'm not the only one who keeps turning away from wholeness. There's one other person who does. I think, though, that might be something that we all face, right? Even if we come in here with that sense of interconnectedness, and I've talked to plenty of people who are newer here who do, who get it, I think maybe we all will hit a place where that sense of expansiveness, we realize that we have, in fact, been putting a boundary around it, right? It often happens when we, at some point, encounter something or someone or some situation that we have othered, right? That we have made the, whatever you want to call it, the enemy, the opposition, Right? And I think that's definitely that was coming out in conversations we had at this this gathering that I mentioned yesterday. And in general, you know, we talked a lot. We talked about our this turning away from wholeness. Certainly around, I mean, we talked a lot about the whole refugee crisis that's happening right now, and how some of the messages are, you know, there are not enough jobs here, there's not enough resources, not enough this, not enough that, and how that can lead people to kind of like circling the wagons, right? In other words, putting up boundaries, right? Putting up boundaries where, you know, we are on the inside and they, whoever they are on the outside. And we talked about the urgent need for, I'll talk more about this later, but the urgent need for Buddhists to realize, to see that functioning clearly and to see through it clearly. There have been recently a couple of Facebook posts that that have really brought this home to me, so I wanted to sort of share them. I follow a Facebook page. It's called Son of Baldwin. Maybe some of you are familiar with it. It's written by and from a real radical black queer point of view, and I've grown to value it highly. It really has made me sort of investigate and examine questions about my various areas of privilege, the various intersections of my identities. It's been very valuable to me. There was a recent post on that page about a pretty recent police shooting of a white man, of an unarmed white man. And it started by referencing the mother of this man, her grief and her confusion. Right? And one of the statements she made was, you know, how could this happen? You know, cops just can't go around shooting people without any consequences. Right? And the person who wrote this post said, oh, but they can. Right? They can, and they do, and they've done that. And then he or she goes on to say, addressing this mother, to say, people just like you, from your exact demographics, have been sitting on juries to exonerate these very same cops when they kill people of color. Then it went on to say, you know, so if you're expecting sympathy from me, you know, my empathy is for black people until the end of white supremacy gives me a reason to share it beyond that. And then, you know, people sort of commented on this, people of color, rose up in complete, mostly, not all, but in a lot of solidarity with that opinion. So I read this and I was really shaken by it, very shaken. And I was trying to work with it by myself and I wasn't working with it well. So I actually turned to some of the people of color in this sangha, right? A group of women of color, who I've, my sisters in this practice, who I've practiced with for a number of years, and who I've done work, anti-racism work within the Sangha with. And I sent it to them and I asked them, can you please help me with this? I need to get some clarity around this. And we agreed. It was heartbreaking. It was absolutely heartbreaking to see that response, right? And we got where it was coming from. You know, we had email exchanges about how people of color and other groups, how their compassion can be depleted, right, by bias, by privilege, and by how that bias and privilege impacts their lives, and often, you know, obviously just very violent, very ways, right? And in the face of this, how easy it is to recoil, right, to make your space of compassion small. Right, and how it's a survival strategy. And one woman in this group I turned to, she even said, given all of this, she said, you know, interconnectedness is a luxury claimed by the privilege. Right? It's interconnectedness itself is privilege, that whole ability to view the world in that way. Right? So I want to acknowledge that there is that piece to this. Right? There, everything about the net of Indra, it includes all of that. Right? And in some ways, our experience of that net is shaped by all of that. You know, it's shaped by what the other jewels in that net our relationship to them. And when that relationship is too painful or causes us pain or causes us suffering or oppression, there is this tendency to reject it, to reject the wholeness, you know. And that even comes out in positive, affirming ways of looking at things. There's another post I read by this black man, George Arnett. I Googled him. I couldn't find any information about him. But he said something similar but different. He said, I want black folks to see blackness as a refuge instead of a cage. I don't want to transcend my blackness, become universal. I want to wade in it, submerge myself in it. And if it comes down to it, I'd rather drown in it than be saved by something outside of it. Right? So with all giving him complete and total respect for his identity, I think maybe we can all substitute parts of our identity into this, right? And to say that there are parts of ourselves, our identity, that are very meaningful to us, right? That we very much value and that we don't want to give up, right? We don't want to see them as a problem. It's a beautiful statement, right? I think in some ways it's a joyous statement. And it's also works on this fear that outside of that identity, there's threat. Right? Outside of that identity, there is something that's going to come and take that away, right? And that this universality is somehow threatening to it, right? So for all these reasons, you know, all of this can make that net feel like a trap, right? Can literally make it feel like a net, right? It's trapping me. And when we feel trapped, we struggle to get free. So how does practice work with this, right? We're here, right? We're here in a place of practice, right, with all of this. And to some, you know, we might be feeling this to one degree or another. But to the degree that we do feel this, right, how do we work with it? We work with it right from the beginning, right? We work with it from the very first moment we start doing zazen. When you come here for beginning instruction, right, and what happens, really, right? We start by taking that net, right? We start by taking the, you know, the beams, the lotuses, the petals, the jewels. We start by taking that dense and just vast and endless kind of texture of interconnectedness, and we reduce it to a net that has exactly two jewels, right? You and your breath. Right? When you're doing zazen, right, in terms of the experience of your practice, that's essentially your world that you're working with. Right, when you start doing zazen, right? It's a net with exactly two jewels. And what we ask you to do is, what we're asked to do is to simply rest in that net and see what happens. Right? So we take this profound universe, and we make it very personal, the breath. We make it very simple, the breath. And we make it very approachable, the breath. And what happens? You know, if you've been doing zazen for more than maybe like a minute, you know what happens, right? Resistance, recoil, right? We can't rest there. Right? We can't rest there. We do endless numbers of things to not simply rest in that state, right? And at first, it might seem like, you know, that's our natural state, and we actually have to kind of cultivate something or create something in order to kind of get past that and finally settle in the breath. But it's actually the opposite, right? We actually have to let go, right? We have to stop that process of creation, right, in order for us to finally be able to rest. Ryushin, who I referred to a little bit back, he actually observes in one of his more recent writings that when we work with the breath, initially and for a long time, what we tend to work with is the idea of the breath, right? And it takes us a while to really be able to connect with the actual breath itself, right? I think this really comes out when we work with pain, right? If you Zazen for any length of time, you know that pain comes up. And beginning instruction, we tell you that when you can't let that pain go, you let the practice shift. And you simply stop letting go. And you simply go right to that pain. You go to it and you hold it in your awareness without adding a thing to it. And when you do that, what happens? You know, there's all manner of resistance, right? The narratives, we start it becomes very real. You know, what we think about the pain, what we think about ourselves thinking about the pain, what we think about everyone else sitting there in apparent no pain, whatever we think about, everything else comes up. But if over time we learn to simply rest, right? To simply allow that pain and us to perfectly reflect each other. Right. And it's kind of good that happens, because in some ways the breath, it's easy to sort of just get sort of lulled into get lulled with it. It's hard to do it with pain. Right? Pain really calls upon an active engagement on our part. You know, there's a Tibetan teacher way back in the 14th century who said that, since neither something nor everything nor nothing exists, whatever occurs is already released. And a very simple way of understanding that is when we're at that place, right, where pain or the breath and us are perfectly reflecting each other, right, it's absolutely impossible to say what exactly that is. Right, because there's no us having a reference point from it to label it, to categorize it, to give it a thingness to it. And at that moment, there's release. Right? That is release from the perspective of practice. And what we release ourselves into is what has always been released, right? That net of complete connection, that net of interconnectedness. Right, it might just be with two jewels, right? But within those two jewels, we're released, and that never ends, right? It's not like we get to a place where we can be done with that, right? If anything, this practice brings that up again and again for us to work with. Certainly, if we go on to do other practices here, that's what comes up in all of our service positions. Every piece of this practice, the way we do it here, liturgy. You know, the only way, I talked about this in beginning instruction today, you know, the only way to really, like that last chant that we do, the Sho Sai Myo, you know, it doesn't mean anything, right? Those are syllables, those are sounds, you know. So the only way to really work with that is to let go of the need for meaning and to completely enter the sound, right? To the extent that we can do that, we will enter into that chant, right? And then we will release ourselves into it, right? So that's what happens in practice. And the basis for all that is the fact that we were already interconnected. We're not inventing something. We're not creating a sense of connection. We're simply releasing ourselves into the connection that was always there. So if the implications of resistance and recoil are, you know, making that net small, of retreating perfectly understandably into issues of survival, into issues of, you know, keeping that our circle of affiliation small, right? Over time we learn to widen that net. Right. A while back, I read this really nice book. It's called The Moral Imagination. Terrible title, but a great book. It's by this guy, John Lederach, who works in peace building. And he's worked in zones of conflict in Latin America and other places as part of people who come in there to actually help resolve conflict, really help to, help people, warring parties to negotiate settlements. And this is his book that he wrote, not so much about the tactics that he uses, but about the art, the sensibility you have to have. And he talks about weaving relational webs within settings of conflict. Right? And he gives very poignant examples of people who aren't professionals, people from those communities who've learned to do this, you know. And he said that, those webs have to intentionally seek to link people who are not like-minded. You know, and he gives really poignant examples of this, of like the women of a village basically going to the generals of like, you know, guerrilla factions who are actually raiding the villages and actually working with them in order to establish these kinds of linkages, right? And he said that, you know, what was really beautiful about this is that he said they didn't so much do solutions, which come and go. Instead, he said, they made linkages capable of continuous response, right? Webs based upon trust, upon mutuality, trust between people who don't trust each other, right? And that are capable of sort of riding the ebb and flow of the tensions and the conflicts that come up, right? You know, he gave this one example of this, I guess it was a priest, a Christian minister from this community who came to this general and said, you know, we need to talk about this. And the general said, okay, but my concern is that if I kind of tell my army to stop, you know, doing whatever, you know, I'm going to be killed. That, you know, that there's so much anger and hatred to me. And he said, okay. And, you know, he said, you know, I can't leave that behind. And so this minister said, okay, how about this? We'll walk together. We'll walk together into the village. We'll do this together so that if anyone is going to be shot, I'll be shot with you. And the guy, you know, the general took it in and he said, okay, you know, if you're willing to do that, you know, I'm willing to do this. And so that's what they did. You know, so it really is this kind of, you know, it was very moving to hear about all of that, you know, and even talk about young people, you know, who approached elders, cutting across all sorts of kind of established hierarchies in these communities in order to sort of make these webs of connections. And there's a Facebook post that I read recently. It was put up by the Southern Poverty Law Center, and it was they shared this article about a mosque that actually paid the fine to get the guy out of jail who painted swastikas on their walls of their mosque, right? This guy, he spray painted swastikas as well as, you know, go home, all sorts of stuff, and he was caught. It was a video camera. He was caught. He was put in jail. And he had to pay, in addition to doing lots of other stuff, he had to pay a fine that he simply couldn't afford. And if he couldn't pay the fine, he was actually going to spend years in jail. So the article said that, you know, the people of the mosque, they met. And it said, you know, he shouldn't go to jail. So, you know, that's not going to solve anything. It's not going to solve his life. It's not going to solve the hatred that led him to do it. It won't solve anything. And so they took a collection. And this is a fine, it's like thousands of dollars. And they paid his fine. Right? The Zen teacher Hung Ji, I think it was back in the 1100s, he, in one of his writings, he says, first, don't establish an identity. Then the world won't impose its conditions. Right? I'm not making a moral judgment here between this example and the examples I just gave at all, but this is an example of how a group of people didn't establish their identity, right, in opposition to someone who, in this example, someone who hates them. Right? They didn't do it. They didn't say, you know, we have to keep our identity tight, right? And to let that person suffer. That person is the enemy. They didn't do that. They didn't establish that identity. Therefore, that person, right, couldn't impose on them. And they were simply free to act. One of the presenters at this gathering yesterday put it this way. You know, she said her name is Beatrice. She's a Buddhist practitioner. I don't know if she's a teacher or not. She's a practitioner, and she actually is with a group called Harriet's Apothecary. That it's a group of Black African-American women who do healing work, body work, wellness work, other forms of alternative healing, and they sort of offer this up as their service. And, you know, she said at a certain point, our intersections are interwoven. And I think that's really beautiful, you know, this whole notion of intersection of the various parts of our identity are interwoven in this net, right? So there are times when, yes, for reasons of survival, absolutely, the net needs to be tight, right? And I'd like to think that there's always a possibility that that net, that those intersections can be interwoven, right, with the rest of that net. Another phrase that came up was activism without an enemy, right, which I think is difficult. It's difficult for me. You know, for me, you know, in order to go out there, it's like I almost feel the need to have something to oppose, right? But what it would like to be an activist without an enemy? So in closing, I just wanted to sort of, I wanted to close with a kind of an interesting little factoid that I encountered when I was researching the net of Indra. You know, I started doing some quick Googling around it, and I sort of learned that the origin of the net, that first example of a net of Indra. Indra is the king of the gods in the Hindu pantheon, was that the net was actually a weapon, right? If you go back to like the Vedic scriptures, there's a line that says, vast indeed is the tactical net of great Indra. By that net, Indra pounces upon enemies so that no enemy may escape arrest and punishment. Now reading this, I'm like what? Like, no. Like it's just weird. I was like, this image of like, you know, just boundless like interconnectedness and interdependency and the compassion and self that come from that kind of started as like a piece of like, you know, military grade hardware, basically, you know. And I sort of like was thinking about that, and then it occurred to me at a certain point, it makes sense. It makes sense from the point of view of practice, because in some ways that's how we start, right? You know, that's what my original resistance was about. I didn't want to give up my tactics, right? This practice kind of realizes that we move through our world tactically, right, constantly. Sometimes for very good reasons, sometimes for not so good reasons, but we move tactically, right, to, you know, this is my sphere of safety, this is my sphere of compassion, this is what I have to give, and this is who I can give it to, and these are the people who are outside of that. Right, and they don't get any either because I don't have it to give, or because they don't deserve it, or because et cetera, right? So, in some ways, it's interesting that development of the net is essentially the development that happens to us as we practice. Right, we move from a place of tactics, right, to a place of recognizing what we have always been a part of. Going back to my struggle with the precepts, that's kind of what did it for me. There was a time when I was in there with Ryushin, and he basically says, you know, isn't it too late by now? I mean, you've been doing these retreats for a long time. You've been in here struggling with this with me. If it didn't matter to you, would you have done any? Like, isn't it too late for you to turn back? And he was speaking about the precept, and I think he was absolutely right, but I think he was also drawing from a much bigger truth in that, you know, it's too late for all of us, right? Because in some ways, you know, we're already in it. You know, we're already part of that net of interconnectedness, that texture of being completely connected with everyone, whether or not we realize it or want to realize it, right? In some ways, it's too late to be out of it, right? It's impossible to be out of it. And practice is really recognizing that, right, and then come working with all the reactions that come out of that. The reaction of insufficiency, the reaction of, you know, but what about like those people over there, you know, that are obviously, you know, doing damage, right? However we define that. What about the other, right? That's the big part of practice, is working with all of that. These women of color who I turned to when I needed help, you know, one of them said, you know, compassion and empathy seem to require time and thoughtfulness, and they also require space to come to fruition. That's practice. That's what this offers us. It offers us time and space, so that all of this, which is completely inherent, which isn't an invention, can come to fruition, so that we can come to fruition. And another woman said, you know, I risk being hurt every day in my intentional effort to authentically connect with people in the world. And that's true. And it's true no matter who we are, no matter how much privilege we have or don't have. And clearly, I'm not equating the two. I think there are people who are much more hurt than others. But I think it can be true for every one of us if we look carefully enough. But then she went on to say, I want to live in a world that's real and not in a reality I create in my mind. So that's what this is. This is about seeing what we're creating in our mind and seeing how, what happens when those creations go out into the world of reality and how those creations simply stop working after a certain point. And then releasing those creations, right? Releasing them so then we can really step in fully into what's bigger than anything we can create. So I just wanted to, again, thank everyone. Thank all of you for your attention. You know, if you're new here, it's very easy to sort of not connect. So please be encouraged. We're going to have, you know, as always, coffee and refreshments upstairs. So if it's your first time here, if you're relatively new, please be encouraged to stay, you know, because within that big connected world, this is a smaller connected world. Right, and it's one that can really offer that kind of support and relations that can really help, because it's hard doing all of this alone, right? And it comes easier when there's a sangha, right? A small immediate sangha to touch base with. So please be encouraged to stay if you're new here, or if you haven't been, you know, if you tend to duck out early, if it's possible, it'll be nice to touch base. So. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for your attention.
Thanks so much for listening. The monastery's quarterly journal, Mountain Record, has a new home at mountainrecord.org. For over 30 years, Mountain Record has been offering spiritual seekers of all faiths a unique journey through words and images. Each quarterly issue delivers a thought-provoking array of classic teachings, contemporary wisdom, stunning photographs, and news from the Mountains and Rivers Order. For more information, to subscribe, or to read our open access articles, visit mountainrecord.org.